This is Audible.
Tim Ferriss presents Vagabonding, an uncommon guide to the art of long-term world travel, written and performed by Rolf Potts. Text copyright 2003 by Rolf Potts. Production copyright 2013 by Tim Ferriss Audio.
This is Tim Ferriss, author of The 4-Hour Workweek, speaking. Many people don't realize that before The 4-Hour Workweek, I traveled the world for a year and a half, starting in 2004. And that really formed the basis for many of the lessons learned that went into The 4-Hour Workweek. And as I traveled, I had next to nothing. It was one suitcase, one backpack, and only two books. One of those books was Walden by Henry David Thoreau, of course. And the other book was Vagabonding, An Uncommon Guide to the Art of Long-Term World Travel by Rolf Potts. I still have that copy. It's actually right in front of me. And I still read 2 to 3 books a week. But Vagabonding is still in my top 10 list. This is because one incredible trip, especially a long-term trip, can change your life forever. Vagabonding teaches you how to travel for the rest of your life. Tim Cahill, author of Hold the Enlightenment, and an incredibly well-known and well-respected travel writer himself, has said of Vagabonding, quote, "I think this is the most sensible book of travel-related advice ever written," end quote. Certainly high praise, and I think well-deserved. In my own dog-eared copy of Vagabonding, I have notes on practically every page, underlinings, highlights, etc., that range from the tactical, how to pack intelligently, what to bring, what not to bring, where to go, to the philosophical, the Upanishads, how to slow down after a lifetime of rushing and caffeine. I also have a wish list of dream destinations on the inside cover, and that includes Stockholm, Prague, Paris, Munich, Berlin, Amsterdam. The list goes on and on and on. Using the tips that Rolf knows so intimately, and that you'll learn in this book, I check them all off. Some of them, for 2 to 3 months at a time, I was able to explore at my own pace with no rushing. Everything in Vagabonding works. This book changed my life completely, and I wish the same for you. Enjoy the adventures. May you have many of them.
Vagabonding. Noun. 1. The act of leaving behind the orderly world to travel independently for an extended period of time. 2. A privately meaningful manner of travel that emphasizes creativity, adventure, awareness, simplicity, discovery, independence, realism, self-reliance, and the growth of the spirit. 3. A deliberate way of living that makes freedom to travel possible. The epigram is from Walt Whitman's Song of the Open Road. "Alons, the road is before us. It is safe. I have tried it. My own feet have tried it. Be not detained. Let the paper remain on the desk unwritten and the book on the shelf unopened. Let the tools remain in the workshop, let the money remain unearned. Let the school stand, mind not the cry of the teacher. Let the preacher preach in his pulpit, let the lawyer plead in his court, let the judge expound the law. Camarado, I give you my hand, I give you my love more precious than money. I give you myself before preaching or law. Will you give me yourself? Will you come travel with me? Shall we stick by each other as long as we live?" Preface. How to use this book. Many travel books can prepare you for an overseas trip, but this book, in sharing a simple, time-honored ethic, can teach you how to travel for the rest of your life. Some books, in offering encyclopedic and often redundant travel information, create the illusion that the best way to plan for an extended trip is to micromanage it. This book, in offering you only the advice you need to prepare for and adapt to the road, encourages you to enrich your travels with the vivid joys of uncertainty. And while some travel books become obsolete after one reading, this book will shed new perspectives and resonate in new ways as your travel career progresses. This book views long-term travel not as an escape, but as an adventure and a passion, a way of overcoming your fears and living life to the fullest. In reading it, you will find out how to gain an impressive wealth of travel time through simplicity. You will find out how to discover and deal with new experiences and adventures on the road. And as much as anything, you will find out how to travel the world on your own terms by overcoming the myths and pretensions that threaten to cheapen your experience. If you've ever felt the urge to travel for extended periods of time but aren't sure how to find the time and freedom to do it, this book is for you. If you've experienced travel before but felt something vital was missing from the experience, this book is for you too. This book is not for daredevils or thrill seekers, but for anyone willing to make an uncommon choice that allows you to travel the world for weeks and months at a time, improvising and saving money as you go. If this sounds like an intriguing possibility, then by all means keep listening. Introduction: How to Win and Influence Yourself. Epigram from Walt Whitman's Song of Myself: All I mark is my own, you shall offset it with your own, else it were time lost listening to me. Not so long ago, as I was taking a slow, decrepit old mail steamer down Burma's Irrawaddy River, I ran out of things to read. When the riverboat called at a small town called Piai, I dashed ashore and bought the only English-language book I could find for sale, a beat-up copy of Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, which I proceeded to read as we slowly steamed towards Rangoon. Somehow, I'd gone through my entire life without ever having read a self-help book. Carnegie's advice, as it turned out, was a charming mix of common sense, be a good listener, good advice, show respect for another man's opinions, and antique notions. Don't forget how profoundly women are interested in clothes. Having enjoyed this book on the river, I gave it away in Rangoon and temporarily forgot about it. About a month later, I was approached to write a book about the art and attitude of long-term travel. Since I'd primarily been endorsing this vagabonding ethic through the narrative stories I'd written for Salon.com, I figured I should probably do some research into the structure and format of advice books. Thus, in the process of trying to relocate a copy of How to Win Friends and Influence People, I discovered that the advice and self-help market has changed a lot since Carnegie's day. Nearly every human activity, desire, and demographic, it seems, is now catered to by some kind of inspirational book. The Chicken Soup for the Soul and Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series by themselves nearly required their own section of the bookstore. Standing there amid the shelves and bewildered at the variety, I began to imagine a vagabonding publishing empire. Not just vagabonding, but vagabonding for teens, vagabonding for singles, vagabonding for golfers, vagabonding your wardrobe, the 10-week vagabonding diet, a vagabonding Christmas, baby's first vagabonding, 101 zesty vagabonding recipes, all I ever really needed to know I learned while vagabonding, and so on. In the end, I left the bookstore without picking up a single book. I decided I would write the book in the only way I knew how, from experience, from passion, and from common sense. If at times this book seems unorthodox, well, good. Vagabonding itself is unorthodox. As for the word vagabonding, I used to think it was my own invention. This was back in 1998 when I was first pitching an adventure travel column to Salon.com. At the time, I wanted a succinct word to describe what I was doing, leaving the ordered world to travel the world on the cheap for an extended period of time. Backpacking seemed too vague a description, globetrotting sounded too pretentious, and touring rang a bit lame. Consequently, I put a playful spin on the word vagabond, the old Latin-derived term that refers to a wanderer with no fixed home, and came up with vagabonding. I'd almost convinced myself that I'd given hip new phrasing to a certain attitude of travel when I discovered a dog-eared paperback entitled Vagabonding in Europe and North Africa on a shelf of a used bookstore in Tel Aviv. Written by an American named Ed Byrne, the book had not only been published before my travel column hit the internet, it had been written before I was born. And in spite of its occasional hippie-era phrasing, example, avoid your travel agent like he was the cops and go out and find the world for yourself, I found Vagabonding in Europe and North Africa to be a fine collection of advice, a level-headed and insightful pre-Lonely Planet take on the nuts, bolts, and philosophy of independent travel. Consequently, discovering Ed Byrne's book was not discouraging so much as it was liberating. It made me realize that, whatever name you give it, the act of vagabonding is not an isolated trend so much as it is, to crib a Greil Marcus phrase, a spectral connection between people long separated by time and place, but somehow speaking the same language. I have since seen reference to the word vagabonding as early as 1871 in Mark Twain's Roughing It, but I've never found it in any dictionary. In a way, it's kind of a nonsense word, playfully adapted to describe a travel phenomenon that was already out there when Walt Whitman wrote, "I or you, pocketless of a dime, may purchase the pick of the earth." Thus, a part of me wants to keep the notion of vagabonding partly rooted in nonsense, as indeterminate, slightly slippery, and open to interpretation as the travel experience itself. So as you prepare to listen to this book, just keep in mind what martial arts master Bruce Lee said. Research your own experiences for the truth. Absorb what is useful. Add what is specifically your own. The creating individual is more than any style or system. On the road, the same holds true for vagabonding. Part 1. Vagabonding. Chapter 1. Declare Your Independence. Of all the outrageous throwaway lines one hears in movies, there's one that stands out for me. It doesn't come from a madcap comedy, an esoteric science fiction flick, or a special effects-laden action thriller. It comes from Oliver Stone's Wall Street, when the Charlie Sheen character, a promising big shot in the stock market, is telling his girlfriend about his dreams. "I think if I can make a bundle of cash before I'm 30 and get out of this racket," he says, "I'll be able to ride my motorcycle across China." When I first saw this scene on video a few years ago, I nearly fell out of my seat in astonishment. After all, Charlie Sheen or anyone else could work for 8 months as a toilet cleaner and have enough money to ride a motorcycle across China. Even if they didn't yet have their own motorcycle, another couple months of scrubbing toilets would earn them enough to buy one when they got to China. The thing is, most Americans probably wouldn't find this movie scene odd. For some reason, we see long-term travel to faraway lands as a recurring dream or an exotic temptation, but not as something that applies to the here and now. Instead, out of our insane duty to fear, fashion, and monthly payments on things we don't really need, we quarantine our travels to short, frenzied bursts. In this way, as we throw our wealth at an abstract notion called lifestyle, travel becomes just another accessory, a smooth-edged, encapsulated experience that we purchase in the same way we buy clothing and furniture. Not long ago, I read that nearly 250,000 short-term monastery and convent-based vacations had been booked and sold by tour agents in the previous year. Spiritual enclaves from Greece to Tibet were turning into hot tourist draws, and travel pundits attributed this solace boom to the fact that busy overachievers are seeking a simpler life. What nobody bothered to point out, of course, is that purchasing a package vacation to find a simpler life is kind of like using a mirror to see what you look like when you aren't looking in the mirror. All that's really sold is the romantic notion of a simpler life, and, just as no amount of turning your head or flicking your eyes will allow you to unself-consciously see yourself in the looking glass, no combination of 1 week or 10-day vacations will truly take you away from the life you lead at home. Ultimately, this shotgun wedding of time and money has a way of keeping us in a holding pattern. The more we associate experience with cash value, the more we think that money is what we need to live. And the more we associate money with life, the more we convince ourselves that we're too poor to buy our own freedom. With this kind of mindset, it's no wonder so many Americans think extended overseas travel is the exclusive realm of students, counterculture dropouts, or the idle rich. In reality, long-term travel has nothing to do with demographics, like age or ideology or income, and everything to do with personal outlook. Long-term travel isn't about being a college student, it's about being a student of daily life. Long-term travel isn't an act of rebellion against society, it's an act of common sense within society. Long-term travel doesn't require a massive bundle of cash. It requires only that we walk through the world in a more deliberate way. This deliberate way of walking through the world has always been intrinsic to a time-honored, quietly available travel tradition known as vagabonding. Vagabonding involves taking an extended time out from your normal life, 6 weeks, 4 months, 2 years, to travel the world on your own terms. But beyond travel, vagabonding is an outlook on life. Vagabonding is about using the prosperity and possibility of the information age to increase your personal options instead of your personal possessions. Vagabonding is about looking for adventure in normal life, and normal life within adventure. Vagabonding is an attitude, a friendly interest in people, places, and things that makes a person an explorer in the truest, most vivid sense of the word. Vagabonding is not a lifestyle, nor is it a trend. It's just an uncommon way of looking at life, a value adjustment from which action naturally follows. And as much as anything, vagabonding is about time, our only real commodity, and how we choose to use it. Sierra Club founder John Muir, an vagabonder if there ever was one, used to express amazement at the well-heeled travelers who would visit Yosemite, only to rush away after a few hours of sightseeing. Muir called these folks the time poor, people who were so obsessed with tending their material wealth and social standing that they couldn't spare time to truly experience the splendor of California's Sierra wilderness. One of Muir's Yosemite visitors in the summer of 1871 was Ralph Waldo Emerson, who gushed upon seeing the sequoias, "It's a wonder we can see these trees and not wonder more." When Emerson scurried off a couple hours later, however, Muir speculated wryly about whether the famous transcendentalist had really seen those trees in the first place. Nearly a century later, naturalist Edwin Way Teal used Muir's example to lament the frenetic pace of modern society. "Freedom as John Muir knew it," he wrote in his 1956 book Autumn Across America, "with its wealth of time, its unregimented days, its latitude of choice, such freedom seems more rare, more difficult to attain, more remote with each new generation." But Teal's lament for the deterioration of personal freedom was just as hollow a generalization in 1956 as it is now. As John Muir was well aware, vagabonding has never been regulated by the fickle public definition of lifestyle. Rather, it has always been a private choice within a society that is constantly urging us to do otherwise. This is a book about living that choice. Part 2. Getting Started. Chapter 2. Earn Your Freedom. There's a story that comes from the tradition of the Desert Fathers, an order of Christian monks who lived in the wastelands of Egypt about 1700 years ago. In the tale, a couple of monks named Theodore and Lucius shared the acute desire to go out and see the world. Since they'd made vows of contemplation, however, this was not something they were allowed to do. So, to satiate their wanderlust, Theodore and Lucius learned to mock their temptations by regulating their travels to the future. When the summertime came, they said to each other, "We will leave in the winter." When the wintertime came, they said, "We will leave in the summer." They went on like this for over 50 years, never once leaving the monastery or breaking their vows. Most of us, of course, have never taken such vows, but we choose to live like monks anyway, rooting ourselves to a home or a career and using the future as a kind of phony ritual that justifies the present. In this way, we end up spending, as Thoreau put it, the best part of one's life earning money in order to enjoy a questionable liberty during the least valuable part of it. We'd love to drop all and explore the world outside, we tell ourselves, but the time never seems right. Thus, given an unlimited amount of choices, we make none. Settling into our lives, we get so obsessed with holding on to our domestic certainties that we forget why we desired them in the first place. Vagabonding is about gaining the courage to loosen your grip on the so-called certainties of this world. Vagabonding is about refusing to exile travel to some other, seemingly more appropriate time of your life. Vagabonding is about taking control of your circumstances instead of passively waiting for them to decide your fate. Thus, the question of how and when to start vagabonding is not really a question at all. Vagabonding starts now. Even if the practical reality of travel is still months or years away, vagabonding begins the moment you stop making excuses, start saving money, and begin to look at maps with the narcotic tingle of possibility. From here, the reality of vagabonding comes into sharper focus as you adjust your worldview and begin to embrace the exhilarating uncertainty that true travel promises. In this way, vagabonding is not merely a ritual of getting immunizations and packing suitcases. Rather, it's the ongoing practice of looking and learning, of facing fears and altering habits, of cultivating a new fascination with people and places. This attitude is not something you can pick up at the airport counter with your boarding pass. It's a process that starts at home. It's a process by which you first test the waters that will pull you into wonderful new places. During this process, you may even find that you aren't up for the uncertainties and adaptations that vagabonding requires. Vagabonding, as Ed Byrne bluntly put it 40 years ago, is not for comfort hounds, sophomoric misanthropes, or poolside faint-hearts whose thin convictions won't stand up to the problems that come along. In saying this, Byrne wasn't being a snob. After all, vagabonding involves sacrifices, and its particular sacrifices are not for everyone. Thus, it's important to keep in mind that you should never go vagabonding out of a vague sense of fashion or obligation. Vagabonding is not a social gesture, nor is it a moral high ground. It's not a seamless 12-step program of travel correctness or a political statement that demands the reinvention of society. Rather, it's a personal act that demands only the realignment of self. If this personal realignment is not something you're willing to confront, or, of course, if world travel isn't your idea of a good time, you have the perfect right to leave vagabonding to those who feel the calling. Ironically, the best litmus test for testing your vagabonding gumption is not found in travel, but in the process of earning your freedom to travel. Earning your freedom, of course, involves work, and work is intrinsic to vagabonding for psychic reasons as much as financial ones. To see the psychic importance of work, one need to look no further than the people who travel the world on family money. Sometimes referred to as trustafarians, these folks are among the most visible and least happy wanderers in the travel milieu. Draping themselves in local fashions, they flit from one exotic travel scene to another, compulsively volunteering in local political causes, experimenting with exotic intoxicants, and dabbling in every non-Western religion imaginable. Talk to them and they'll tell you they're searching for something meaningful. What they're really looking for, though, is the reason why they started traveling in the first place. Because they never worked for their freedom, their travel experiences have no personal reference, no connection to the rest of their lives. They are spending plenty of time and money on the road, but they never spend enough of themselves to begin with. Thus, their experience of travel has a diminished sense of value. Thoreau touched on this same notion in Walden. Which would be most advanced by the end of a month, he posited. The boy who had made his own jackknife, from the ore which he had dug and smelted, reading as much as possible as would be necessary for this, or the boy who had received a Rogers penknife from his father? Which would be most likely to cut his fingers? At a certain level, the idea that freedom is tied to labor might seem a bit depressing. It shouldn't be. For all the amazing experiences that await you in distant lands, the meaningful part of travel always starts at home, with a personal investment in the wonders to come. I don't like work, says Marlowe in Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, but I like what's in the work, the chance to find yourself. Marlowe wasn't referring to vagabonding, but the notion still applies. Work is not just an activity that generates funds and creates desire. It's the vagabonding gestation period, wherein you earn your integrity, start making plans, and get your proverbial act together. Work is a time to dream about travel and to write notes to yourself, but it's also time to tie up your loose ends. Work is when you confront the problems that you might otherwise be tempted to run away from. Work is how you settle your financial and emotional debts, so that your travels are not an escape from your real life, but a discovery of your real life. On a practical level, there are countless ways to earn your travels. On the road, I've met vagabonders of all ages, from all backgrounds and walks of life. I've met secretaries, bankers, and policemen who quit their jobs and are taking a peripatetic pause before trying something new. I've met lawyers, stockbrokers, and social workers who've negotiated months off as they take their careers to new locations. I've met talented specialists, waiters, web designers, strippers, who find they can fund months of travel on a few weeks of work. I've met musicians, truck drivers, and employment counselors who are taking an extended time off between gigs. I've met semi-retired soldiers and engineers and businessmen who've reserved a year or two for travel before dabbling in something else. Some of the most prolific vagabonders I've met are seasonal workers, carpenters, park service workers, commercial fishermen, who winter every year in warm and exotic parts of the world. Other folks, teachers, doctors, bartenders, journalists, have opted to take their very careers on the road, alternating work and travel as they see fit. Many vagabonders don't even maintain a steady job description, taking short-term work only as it serves to fund their travels and their passions. In Generation X, Douglas Copeland defined this kind of work as an anti-sabbatical, a job approached with the sole intention of staying for a limited period of time, often 1 year, to raise enough funds to partake in another, more personally meaningful activity. Before I got into writing, a whole slew of anti-sabbaticals, like landscaping, retail sales, and temp work, earned me my vagabonding time. Of all the anti-sabbaticals that funded my travels, though, no experience was quite as vivid as the 2 years I spent teaching English in Busan, South Korea. In addition to learning tons about Asian social customs through my work, I discovered that the simple act of walking to work was itself an exercise in possibility. On a given day in Korea, I was equally likely to be greeted by a Buddhist monk wearing Air Jordans as I was by a woman in a stewardess uniform handing out promotional toilet tissue. I eventually stopped noticing such details as children screaming hello, old men urinating in public, and vegetable truck loudspeakers blasting Edelweiss. After 2 years on the job, I actually found myself fighting boredom as I crooned California Dreaming with my salaryman tutees in a room full of mini-skirted 17-year-old karaoke hostesses. And on top of all this, the pay was pretty good. However you choose to fund your travel freedom, keep in mind that your work is an active part of your travel attitude. Even if your anti-sabbatical job isn't your life's calling, approach your work with a spirit of faith, mindfulness, and thrift. In such a manner, Thoreau was able to meet all his living expenses at Walden Pond by working just 6 weeks a year. Since vagabonding is more involved than freelance philosophizing, however, you might have to invest a bit more time in scraping together your travel funds. Regardless of how long it takes to earn your freedom, remember that you are laboring for more than just a vacation. A vacation, after all, merely rewards work. Vagabonding justifies it. Ultimately, then, the first step of vagabonding is simply a matter of making work serve your interests instead of the other way around. Believe it or not, this is a radical departure from how most people view work and leisure. A few years ago, a magazine editor named Joe Robinson spearheaded a petition campaign called Work to Live. The goal of this movement was to pass a law that would increase American vacation time to 3 weeks after 1 year on the job and to 4 weeks after 3 years. The rationale was that Americans place too much emphasis on work, that all we have to look forward to from day to day is a long tunnel of 11.5 months of work every year. The leading casualty of all this is our time, said Robinson, that commodity we seem to have so much of back in sixth grade when the clock on the wall never seemed to move. Robinson's campaign was a worthy one, and it found plenty of support at the grassroots level and a fair amount of antagonism in corporate circles. Amid all this publicity, however, I was amazed that nobody was subversive enough to point out the obvious. As citizens of a stable, prosperous democracy, any one of us has the power to create our own free time, outside the whims of federal laws and private sector policies. Indeed, if the clock appears to move faster than it did in the sixth grade, it's only because we haven't actualized our power as adults to set our own recess schedule. To actualize this power, we merely need to make strategic use, if only for a few weeks or months, of a time-honored personal freedom technique popularly known as quitting. And despite its pejorative implication, quitting need not be as reckless as it sounds. Many people are able to create vagabonding time through constructive quitting, that is, negotiating with their employers for special sabbaticals and long-term leaves of absence. Even leaving your job in a more permanent manner need not be a negative act, especially in an age when work is likely to be defined by job specialization and the fragmentation of tasks. Whereas working a job with the intention of quitting it might have been an act of recklessness 100 years ago, it is more and more often becoming an act of common sense in an age of portable skills and diversified employment options. Keeping this in mind, don't worry that your extended travels might leave you with a gap on your resume. Rather, you should enthusiastically and unapologetically include your vagabonding experience on your resume when you return. List the job skills travel has taught you: independence, flexibility, negotiation, planning, boldness, self-sufficiency, improvisation. Speak frankly and confidently about your travel experiences. Odds are your next employer will be interested and impressed and a wee bit envious. As Pico Iyer pointed out, the act of quitting means not giving up but moving on. Changing direction not because something doesn't agree with you, but because you don't agree with something. It's not a complaint, in other words, but a positive choice, and not a stop in one's journey, but a step in a better direction. Quitting, whether a job or a habit, means taking a turn so as to be sure you're still moving in the direction of your dreams. In this way, quitting a job to go vagabonding should never be seen as the end of something grudging and unpleasant. Rather, it's a vital step in beginning something new and wonderful. Vagabonding Profile, Walt Whitman. Should vagabonding have a patron saint, it would be the 19th century poet Walt Whitman, if for no other reason than Song of the Open Road, his infectiously joyous ode to the spirit of travel. Born in 1819 to a working-class family in New York, Whitman entered the working world as an office boy at age 11. It was here and at his later employment as a printer's apprentice that he developed a passion for self-education, as well as an eye for finding uncommon beauty in the common activity of daily life. Whitman eventually moved on to work as a journalist, but his real life's work was Leaves of Grass, a collection of free-spirited verse that grew to more than 300 poems by the time of his death in 1892. As a youth, Whitman was particularly inspired by his daily ferry trips from Brooklyn to Manhattan, which instilled in him a lasting appreciation for the uncommon joys and vivid details of travel. And while his later travels took him to budding American outposts such as New Orleans and Denver, it is this celebration of simple movement and possibility that gives Song of the Open Road its visceral and inclusive energy. To see nothing anywhere but that you may reach it and pass it. To conceive no time, however distant, but you may reach it and pass it. To look up or down no road, but it stretches and waits for you. To know the universe itself as a road, as many roads, as roads for traveling souls. Vagabonding Voices. The following testimonies are from real vagabonders who've traveled the road themselves.
This is Tim Ferriss, a 36-year-old author in San Francisco, California. For all the most important things in life, the timing always sucks. Waiting for a good time to quit your job, to have that kid, to take a dream trip. Sadly, the traffic lights of life will never all be green at the same time. Conditions are never perfect. Someday, in quotation marks, someday I'll do this, someday I'll do that, is a disease that will take your dreams to the grave with you. Pro and con lists, one of my previous favorites, are just as bad. If it's important to you and you want to do it eventually, just do it and correct course along the way. Fortune favors the bold.
This is Jen Miller, a 39-year-old freelance writer from Canada. Your freedom matters more than anything, and you win that freedom the moment you make the decision to hit the road. When you commit 100% to your dream and you begin doing the work necessary to free yourself and move into the new reality of traveling, you're already on the road.
This is Cassidy Amick, a 29-year-old advertising account executive from Arizona. My younger brother asked me what I feared more, leaving my stable job of 2 years in a terrible economy or backpacking through India, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam on my own. That exact moment, my heart skipped a beat. Even though embarking on a new travel adventure across Southeast Asia seemed impossible at the time, it also gave me butterflies, the kind that makes you decide to take the leap of faith. I knew what I had to do. I submitted my 2 weeks' notice shortly after because I knew it would all work itself out in the end.
This is Ann Van Loen, a 43-year-old teacher from Seattle, Washington. When we first told our family and close friends that we were planning on taking our kids out of school for a year of travel in the world, we received more than our share of sideways looks and skeptical questions. We persevered, though, and soon most of our friends were won over by our positive focus and enthusiasm. Don't let yourself get talked out of your travel dream. Leaving actually turned out to be much harder than the travel experience. Just go.
Quotes for Chapter 2. First is from Henry David Thoreau in Walden. If one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. He will put some things behind, will pass an invisible boundary. New, universal, and more liberal laws will begin to establish themselves around and within him. The Supreme Teaching of the Upanishads. And they say in truth that a man is made of desire. As his desire is, so is his faith. As his faith is, so are his works. As his works are, so he becomes. Ed Burren, Vagabonding in Europe and North Africa. Wanting to travel reflects a positive attitude. You want to see, to grow in experience, and presumably to become more whole as a human being. Vagabonding takes this a step further. It promotes the chances of sustaining and strengthening this positive attitude. As a vagabond, you begin to face your fears now and then instead of continuously sidestepping them in the name of convenience. You build an attitude that makes life more rewarding, which in turn makes it easier to keep doing it. It's called positive feedback, and it works. Edward Abbey, Desert Solitaire. We need the possibility of escape as surely as we need hope. Without it, the life of the cities would drive all men into crime, or drugs, or psychoanalysis. Tim Cahill from Hold the Enlightenment. A lot of us first aspired to far-ranging travel and exotic adventure early in our teens. These ambitions are, in fact, adolescent in nature, which I find an inspiring idea. Thus, when we allow ourselves to imagine as we once did, we know with a sudden jarring clarity that if we don't go right now, we're never going to do it, and we'll be haunted by our unrealized dreams and know that we have sinned against ourselves gravely. Thomas Merton, from the Asian Journal of Thomas Merton. And so I stand among you as one that offers a small message of hope, that first, there are always people who dare to seek on the margin of society, who are not dependent on social acceptance, not dependent on social routine, and prefer a kind of free-floating existence. Tip Sheet, Chapter 2. Please visit vagabonding.net/resources for resources related to sabbaticals, unpaid leave and quitting your job, finding jobs and careers overseas, international employment references, and overseas dangers. Before we jump to the next chapter, I'd like to add a few comments about overseas dangers. One of the big issues these days among potential vagabonders is whether or not it's safe to travel overseas anymore. The short answer to this concern is that traveling around the world is statistically no more dangerous than traveling across your hometown. Indeed, as with home, most dangers and annoyances on the road revolve around sickness, theft, and accidents, things I'll discuss in Chapter 7, not political violence or terrorism. Should political violence or terrorism capture headlines, however, the secret to avoiding it is not to cancel your travel plans, but simply to keep yourself informed. Just because the evening news shows unrest in a southern Lebanon refugee camp, for instance, doesn't mean it's dangerous to visit Beirut or Galilee, or for that matter, other parts of southern Lebanon. By that same token, the evening news might habitually ignore the political situation in West Africa, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's safe to visit Sierra Leone or Liberia. Obviously, then, planning and monitoring your destinations will require that you look past the evening news. Online resources, such as U.S. State Department travel warnings and a website called World Travel Watch, make good starting points for assessing the current safety situation in any given part of the world. Even if you accidentally find yourself in a dangerous area as you travel, the key to keeping safe is knowing and talking to the locals, who can tell you where specific dangers lurk, patronizing mom-and-pop businesses, which are never targeted in political attacks, avoiding a loud or flashy appearance, this includes dogmatic debates of religion and politics, and traveling outside of predictable tourist patterns, which are easier to target by troublemakers. In short, the engaged and humbled attitude of vagabonding will naturally lend to a safer journey. Should the security situation seem especially tense in a region, go a step further and avoid hangouts that cater exclusively to foreigners, expat bars, hard rock cafes, and the like. Stay away from public demonstrations and crowds, this includes small bands of drunks and rabble-rousers, and don't share your travel plans or lodging arrangements with strangers. On a final note, keep in mind that most people in the world see you not as a political entity or an appendage of the great Satan, but as a guest to their country. Even if they vehemently disagree with your country's policies and practices, they will invariably honor your individuality and regard you with hospitality and respect. You'd never guess this by watching the evening news, of course, but travel allows you to experience the nuances of the world in a way that mass media never will. Remember, for these resources, go to vagabonding.net/resources. Chapter 3. Keep It Simple. In March 1989, the Exxon Valdez struck a reef off the coast of Alaska, resulting in the largest oil spill in U.S. history. Initially viewed as an ecological disaster, this catastrophe did wonders to raise environmental awareness among average Americans. As television images of oil-choked sea otters and dying shorebirds were beamed across the country, pop environmentalism grew into a national craze. Instead of conserving more and consuming less, however, many Americans sought to save the earth by purchasing environmental products. Energy-efficient home appliances flew off the shelves, health food sales boomed, and reusable canvas shopping bags became vogue in strip malls from Jacksonville to Jackson Hole. Credit card companies began to earmark a small percentage of profits for conservation groups, thus encouraging consumers to help the environment by striking off on idealistic shopping binges. Such shopping sprees and health food purchases did very little to improve the state of the planet, of course, but most people managed to feel a little better about the situation without having to make any serious lifestyle changes. This notion, that material investment is somehow more important to life than personal investment, is exactly what leads so many of us to believe that we could never afford to go vagabonding. The more our life options get paraded around as consumer options, the more we forget that there's a difference between the two. Thus, having convinced ourselves that buying things is the only way to play an active role in the world, we fatalistically conclude that we'll never be rich enough to purchase a long-term travel experience. Fortunately, the world need not be a consumer product. As with environmental integrity, long-term travel isn't something you buy into. It's something you give yourself. Indeed, the freedom to go vagabonding has never been determined by income level. It's found through simplicity, the conscious decision of how to use what income you have. And contrary to popular stereotypes, seeking simplicity doesn't require that you become a monk or a subsistence forager or a wild-eyed revolutionary. Nor does it mean that you must unconditionally avoid the role of consumer. Rather, simplicity merely requires a bit of personal sacrifice, an adjustment of your habits and routines within consumer society itself. At times, the biggest challenge in embracing simplicity will be the vague feeling of isolation that comes with it, since private sacrifice doesn't garner as much attention in the frenetic world of mass culture. Jack Kerouac's legacy as a cultural icon is a good example of this. Arguably the most famous American vagabonder of the 20th century, Kerouac vividly captured the epiphanies of hand-to-mouth travel in books like On the Road and Lonesome Traveler. In The Dharma Bums, he wrote about the joy of living with people who blissfully ignore the general demand that they consume production and therefore have to work for the privilege of consuming all that crap they really didn't want, general junk you always see a week later in the garbage anyway, all of it impersonal in a system of work, produce, consume. Despite his observance of material simplicity, however, Kerouac found that his personal life, the life that had afforded him the freedom to travel, was soon overshadowed by a more fashionable and marketable public vision of his travel lifestyle. Convertible cars, jazz records, marijuana, and later Gap khakis, ultimately came to represent the mystical it that he and Neil Cassidy sought in On the Road. As his beat cohort William S. Burroughs was to point out years after Jack's death, part of Kerouac's mystique became inseparable from the idea that he opened up a million coffee bars and sold a million pairs of Levi's to both sexes. In some ways, of course, coffee bars, convertibles, and marijuana are all part of what made travel appealing to Kerouac's readers. That's how marketing, intentional and otherwise, works. But these aren't the things that made travel possible for Kerouac. What made travel possible was that he knew that neither self nor wealth can be measured in terms of what you consume or own. Even the downtrodden souls on the fringes of society, he observed, had something the rich didn't. Time. This notion, the notion that riches don't necessarily make you wealthy, is as old as society itself. The ancient Hindu Upanishads refer disdainfully to that chain of possessions wherewith men bind themselves and beneath which they sink. Ancient Hebrew scriptures declare that whoever loves money never has money enough. Jesus noted that it's pointless for a man to gain the whole world yet lose his very self, and the Buddha whimsically pointed out that seeking happiness in one's material desires is as absurd as suffering because a banana tree will not bear mangoes. Despite several millennia of such warnings, however, there is still an overwhelming social compulsion, an insanity of consensus, if you will, to get rich from life rather than to live richly, to do well in the world instead of living well. And in spite of the fact that America is famous for its unhappy rich people, most of us remain convinced that just a little more money will set life right. In this way, the messianic metaphor of modern life becomes the lottery, the outside chance that the right odds will come together and liberate us from financial worries once and for all. Fortunately, we were all born with winning tickets, and cashing them in is a simple matter of altering our cadence as we walk through the world. Vagabonding sage Ed Byrne knew as much. By switching to a new game, which in this case involves vagabonding, time becomes the only possession, and everyone is equally rich in it by biological inheritance. Money, of course, is still needed to survive, but time is what you need to live. So, save what little money you possess to meet the basic survival requirements, but spend your time lavishly in order to create the life values that make the fire worth the candle. Dig? Dug. And the best part is, as you cultivate your future with rich fields of time, you are also sowing the seeds of personal growth that will gradually bloom as you travel into the world. In a way, simplifying your life for vagabonding is easier than it sounds. This is because travel by its very nature demands simplicity. If you don't believe it, just go home and try stuffing everything you own into a backpack. This will never work because no matter how meagerly you live at home, you can't match the scaled-down minimalism that travel requires. You can, however, set the process of reduction and simplification into motion while you're still at home. This is useful on several levels. Not only does it help you to save travel money, but it helps you realize how independent you are of your possessions and your routines. In this way, it prepares you mentally for the realities of the road and makes travel a dynamic extension of the life alterations you began at home. As with, say, giving up coffee, simplifying your life will require a somewhat difficult consumer withdrawal period. Fortunately, your impending travel experience will give you a very tangible and rewarding long-term goal that helps ease the discomfort. Over time, as you reap the sublime rewards of simplicity, you will begin to wonder how you ever put up with such a cluttered life in the first place. On a basic level, there are three general methods to simplifying your life: stopping expansion, reining in your routine, and reducing clutter. The easiest part of this process is stopping expansion. This means that, in anticipation of vagabonding, you don't add any new possessions to your life, regardless of how tempting they might seem. Naturally, this rule applies to things like cars and home entertainment systems, but it also applies to travel accessories. Indeed, one of the biggest mistakes people make in anticipation of vagabonding is to indulge in a vicarious travel buzz by investing in water filters, sleeping bags, and travel boutique wardrobes. In reality, vagabonding runs smoothest on a bare minimum of gear, and even multi-year trips require little initial investment beyond sturdy footwear and a dependable travel bag or backpack. While you're curbing the material expansion of your life, you should also take pains to rein in the unnecessary expenses of your weekly routine. Simply put, this means living more humbly, even if you aren't humble, and investing the difference into your travel fund. Instead of eating at restaurants, for instance, cook at home and pack a lunch for school or work. Instead of partying at nightclubs and going out to movies or pubs, entertain at home with friends or family. Wherever you see the chance to eliminate an expensive habit, take it. The money you save as a result will pay off handsomely in travel time. In this way, I ate a lot of bologna sandwiches and missed out on a lot of grunge-era Seattle nightlife while saving up for a vagabonding stint after college, but the ensuing 8 months of freedom on the roads of North America more than made up for it. Perhaps the most challenging step in keeping things simple is reducing clutter, downsizing what you already own. As Thoreau observed, downsizing can be the most vital step in winning the freedom to change your life. "I have in my mind that most seemingly wealthy but most terribly impoverished class of all," he wrote in Walden, "who have accumulated dross but do not know how to use it or get rid of it and thus have forged their own golden or silver fetters." How you reduce your dross in anticipation of travel will depend on your situation. If you're young, odds are you haven't accumulated enough to hold you down, which incidentally is a big reason why so many vagabonders tend to be young. If you're not so young, you can recreate the carefree conditions of youth by jettisoning the things that aren't necessary to your basic well-being. For much of what you own, garage sales and online auctions can do wonders to unclutter your life and score you an extra bit of cash to boot. Homeowners can win their travel freedom by renting out their houses. Those who rent accommodations can sell, store, or lend out the things that might bind them to one place. An additional consideration in life simplification is debt. As Laurel Lee wryly observed in Godspeed, cities are full of those who have been caught in monthly payments for avocado green furniture sets. Thus, if at all possible, don't let avocado green furniture sets, or any other seemingly innocuous indulgence, dictate the course of your life by forcing you into ongoing cycles of production and consumption. If you're already in debt, work your way out of it and stay out. If you have a mortgage or other long-term debt, devise a situation, such as property rental, that allows you to be independent of its obligations for long periods of time. Being free from debt's burden simply gives you more vagabonding options, and, for that matter, more life options. As you simplify your life and look forward to spending your new wealth of time, you're likely to get a curious reaction from your friends and family. On one level, they will express enthusiasm for your impending adventures. But on another level, they might take your growing freedom as a subtle criticism of their own way of life. Because your fresh worldview might appear to call their own values into question, or at least force them to consider those values in a new light, they will tend to write you off as irresponsible and self-indulgent. Let them. As I've said before, vagabonding is not an ideology, a balm for societal ills, or a token of social status. Vagabonding is, was, and always will be a private undertaking. And its goal is to improve your life not in relation to your neighbors, but in relation to yourself. Thus, if your neighbors consider your travels foolish, don't waste your time trying to convince them otherwise. Instead, the only sensible reply is to quietly enrich your life with the myriad opportunities that vagabonding provides. Interestingly, some of the harshest responses I've received in reaction to my vagabonding life have come while traveling. Once, at Armageddon, the site in Israel, not the battle at the end of the world, I met an American aeronautical engineer who was so tickled at having negotiated 5 days of free time into a Tel Aviv consulting trip that he spoke of little else as we walked through the ruined city. When I eventually mentioned that I'd been traveling around Asia for the past 18 months, he looked at me as if I'd slapped him. "You must be filthy rich," he said acidly. "Or maybe," he said, giving me the once-over, "your mommy and daddy are." I tried to explain how 2 years of teaching English in Korea had funded my freedom, but the engineer would have none of it. Somehow he couldn't accept that 2 years of any kind of honest work could have funded 18 months and counting of travel. He didn't even bother to stick around for the real kicker. In those 18 months of travel, my day-to-day costs were significantly cheaper than they would have been back in the United States. The secret to my extraordinary thrift was neither secret nor extraordinary. I had tapped into that vast well of free time simply by foregoing a few comforts as I traveled. Instead of luxury hotels, I slept in clean, basic hostels and guest houses. Instead of flying from place to place, I took local buses, trains, and share taxis. Instead of dining at fancy restaurants, I ate food from street vendors and local cafeterias. Occasionally, I traveled on foot, slept out under the stars, and dined for free at the stubborn insistence of local hosts. In what ultimately amounted to over 2 years of travel in Asia, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East, my lodging averaged out to just under $5 a night. My meals cost well under a dollar a plate, and my total expenses rarely exceeded $1,000 a month. Granted, I have simple tastes, and I didn't linger long in expensive places, but there was nothing exceptional in the way I traveled. In fact, entire multinational backpacker circuits, not to mention budget guidebook publishing empires, had been created by the simple abundance of such travel bargains in the developing world. For what it costs to fill your gas tank back home, for example, you can take a train from one end of China to the other. For the price of a home-delivered pepperoni pizza, you can eat great meals for a week in Brazil. And for a month's rent in any major American city, you can spend a year in a beach hut in Indonesia. Moreover, even the industrialized parts of the world host enough hostel networks, bulk transportation discounts, and camping opportunities to make long-term travel affordable. Ultimately, you may well discover that vagabonding on the cheap becomes your favorite way to travel, even if given more expensive options. Indeed, not only does simplicity save you money and buy you time, it also makes you more adventuresome, forces you into sincere contact with locals, and allows you the independence to follow your passions and curiosities down exciting new roads. In this way, simplicity, both at home and on the road, affords you the time to seek renewed meaning in an oft-neglected commodity that can't be bought at any price, life itself. Vagabonding Profile, Henry David Thoreau. Although Henry David Thoreau never traveled very far outside of New England, he promoted an uncommon view of wealth that is essential to vagabonding. Considering all material possessions beyond basic necessities to be an obstacle to true living, he espoused the idea that wealth is found not in what you own, but in how you spend your time. "A man is rich," he wrote in Walden, "in proportion to the number of things he can afford to let alone." Born in Concord, Massachusetts in 1817, Thoreau trained as an engineer at Harvard, although he never could pinpoint his true profession. At various times, he called himself a schoolteacher, a surveyor, a farmer, a house painter, a pencil maker, a writer, and sometimes a pot taster. It is as a writer that he is best remembered, particularly for his book Walden, the vivid account of his one-year experiment in anti-materialist living. At Walden Pond, Thoreau lived in such a way that he only had to work 6 weeks a year, eating vegetables from his garden and fish from the pond, living in a tight, light, and clean house that he built himself, avoiding unnecessary expenses, including fresh meat, fancy clothes, and coffee. This left him with ample time to indulge in the things he loved best: reading, writing, walking, thinking, and observing nature. In this way, through simplicity, Thoreau was able to find true wealth. "Superfluous wealth can buy superfluities only," he wrote. "Money is not required to buy one necessity of the soul." Vagabonding Voices, Chapter 3.
This is Derek Orth, a 28-year-old voice actor from Florida. Here's a fun, money-saving trick I use. I give up some luxury at home and instead visualize an experience I could only have on the road. Instead of going out for steak, I picture the sushi I could be eating in Osaka. Instead of buying another guitar, I envision scuba diving a coral reef in the Philippines. The imagination is a powerful tool. I use it to feast on all the possibilities awaiting me on my trip, and my wallet never leaves my pocket.
This is Noah Van Loen, a 45-year-old consultant from Seattle, Washington. We embraced and even enjoyed the process of getting rid of all of the stuff that we had accumulated during 15 years of homeownership, marriage, and raising kids. Selling, donating, and just disposing of material possessions frees you to focus on what's really important. Hint, it's not the stuff. We made a resolution not to buy new things and thought long and hard about how we were spending our money.
This is Meg Schofield, a 44-year-old working for the federal government in Washington, D.C. Getting rid of the car became the bedrock of our simplicity commitment at home. It felt radical in this city known for its opulence and ego. We weren't prepared for the wistful reactions of our neighbors and friends when we explained our new car-free existence. "We wish we could do that," they said, followed by a profuse list of excuses. Too many activities, public transportation's lack of dependability, the distance of shopping opportunities. As for us, we're learning our neighborhood in an intimate way only possible by walking the streets every day in all moods and weather. The money that we save each month goes to our future fund so we can soon explore neighborhoods in faraway places.
This is Johnny Ward, a travel blogger and a lifestyle designer from Ireland. When you're actually traveling, you'll realize you don't need much stuff to feel fulfilled. If you can bring that mindset forward a few months, that attitude will save you a fortune at home. Cut out the noise, focus on the goal.
Quotes, Chapter 3. From an ancient Sanskrit poem. From all your herds, a cup or two of milk. From all your granaries, a loaf of bread. In all your palace, only half a bed. Can a man use more, and do you own the rest? John Muir, from Kindred and Related Spirits. Our crude civilization engenders a multitude of wants. Our forefathers forged chains of duty and habit, which bind us notwithstanding our boasted freedom, and we ourselves in desperation add link to link, groaning and making medicinal laws for relief. Walt Whitman, from Song of the Open Road. Henceforth I ask not good fortune, I myself am good fortune. Henceforth I whimper no more, postpone no more, need nothing. Pico Iyer, from Why We Travel. Travel can be a kind of monasticism on the move. On the road, we often live more simply, with no more possessions than we can carry, and surrendering ourselves to chance. This is what Camus meant when he said that what gives value to travel is fear. Disruption, in other words, or emancipation from circumstance, and all the habits behind which we hide. Bertrand Russell, from The Conquest of Happiness. Very many people spend money in ways quite different from those that their natural tastes would enjoin, merely because the respect of their neighbors depends upon the possession of a good car and their ability to give good dinners. As a matter of fact, any man who can obviously afford a car but genuinely prefers travels or a good library will in the end be much more respected than if he had behaved exactly like everyone else. Ralph Waldo Emerson, from Self-Reliance. It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after your own. But the great man is he who in the midst of the crowd keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude. Ralph Bagnold, from Libyan Sands. When I was very young, a big financier once asked me what I would like to do, and I said, to travel. Ah, he said, it is very expensive. One must have a lot of money to do that. He was wrong. For there are two types of travelers, the comfortable voyager, round whom a cloud of voracious expenses hums all the time, and the man who shifts for himself and enjoys the little discomforts as a change from life's routine. Tip Sheet, Chapter 3. Please visit vagabonding.net/resources for up-to-date resources on lifestyle simplicity, budgeting and money management, and vagabonding for seniors and families. Before we move on to the next chapter, a few notes about vagabonding for seniors and families. Statistically, most vagabonders are 18 to 35 years old and childless, but this doesn't mean that youthful independence is a prerequisite for long-term travel. Indeed, some of the most